Velvet Podcast. Literature, genre fiction,
horror, sci-fi, neo-noir, speculative,
writing, films, music, and probably a few dick jokes. And now, recorded via the magic of the internet, please welcome this episode's hosts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is the Cinemuck episode of the Velvet Podcast. We've gathered a few folks here today with an affinity for film. My name is Gordon Highland. I'm from Kansas City, and I go by Flash on The Velvet. Welcome to TheVelvet.com. We'll do a quick roundtable here right quick so listeners can tell whose voices are whose. First, from the Minneapolis area, we have...
Jesse Lawrence on The Velvet.
And then we have the admin of The Velvet from North Hollywood.
Hey, I'm Logan Frost.
And our returning champion and our special surprise guest from Boulder, Colorado...
Stephen Graham Jones.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us, guys.
Today's topic.
First of all, before we get too far into this, I want to talk about taste a little bit here right off the top. I don't want to get into too much like list making or whatnot, but why do you guys think there's such a divide between what people consider the quote-unquote best films, and which, you know, I know you can't really quantify such a thing like that, art and whatnot, but there at least tends to be sort of a general big picture consensus as to what some of those great films are. But how do you contrast that versus individual people's so-called favorites, and why do you think the two are so often like mistaken for each other in this world of tastemakers?
Well, for me, as far as what I would consider some of the best films out there, I would say predominantly it comes to what the purpose of the film was. Let's take No Country for Old Men, for example. I wouldn't say that's my favorite film of all time, but it is what you would consider moment by moment a perfect film, where in all of the elements, directing, acting, writing, director photography, all that, it all came together seamlessly. I would say that is one of the best films in recent years. However, I wouldn't say Can't Hardly Wait is one of the best films ever, but it is certainly one of my favorites, just because it's something that speaks specifically to me personally. And that's why, you know, I would say something that has that's effective in a broad sense, like No Country for Old Men, where it hits the beats just perfectly, that any audience could watch that and typically enjoy it.
Do you think any of that has to do with when you saw it and the people you saw it with, or what was going on in your life at that time, maybe?
Well, it would be silly to say that didn't have any effect on it, just because whenever you're experiencing art, regardless of whether it's film, TV, even radio dramas, it's always within the context of your personal situation at the time. Like, let's say No Country for Old Men or The Hurt Locker, where they are great films to where, regardless of that situation, you can still be affected by it. You know, sometimes I'm just not in the mood for a romantic comedy. Well, I'm rarely in the mood for a romantic comedy. But if No Country for Old Men is on, that's one of those have to watch, because every moment is just arresting.
How about you, Jesse? What do you think?
I think Logan said it pretty well. A lot of times with the best, it's kind of also about craft more so than just the story itself, which is what is really going to engage me, is the characters and the dialogue and the movement of the whole thing. But when you take things like craft into that too, the way it's shot and whether it's hitting those beats every step of the way, I think that's a really big part of it.
So would you say that some of your favorite films are also some of the best films you've ever seen, or are the two very distinct for you?
I think they're very distinct, especially since I really love a lot of horror films and whatnot, and some of them are very, very well done and masterful, like Suspiria. It's just incredible, the art direction and cinematography on that. So that might be closer to one of that's a best and a favorite, but take other films, say Jennifer's Body. I'm not going to say that's, you know, the best film.
But you enjoyed it, though, didn't you?
I did enjoy it.
Oh, you're killing me, Jesse.
You know, like, Apocalypse Now, it's a great film. It's not one of my favorites by any means, though, but it is still one of probably the best, and some people I've heard will even argue it is the best American film ever made.
So Steven, you want to weigh in on some of this whole best versus favorite?
Yeah, sure. Well, first, I love Jennifer's Body, too. But... yeah, I hate it when I ask somebody for, like, give me your favorite, you know, best 20 films. And and they drop into some out loud essay. They start with Birth of the Nation, and they jump up to Nosferatu, and they're cycling through everything that's the foundation of cinema. And that's not what a best of or favorite list should be. It shouldn't be tracking back to get the whole craft and everything down. That's completely boring to me. I don't see how anybody's favorite movie could be Nosferatu or Birth of a Nation or any of that stuff. It's kind of like how when you're 14 years old, you put all these posters on your wall, and you're waiting for somebody to come in and see those posters, and they're seeing like into your soul, but it's not your soul; it's the soul you've constructed on the wall. And that's what so many people do with their 10 best movies list. They pick movies that they know are, you know, quality and that everybody likes them, and they won't pick like Overboard or something, even if that is their favorite movie.
Like the Goldie Hawn movie.
Exactly. I love that movie.
I love Overboard too, man, so much.
They made a sequel?
I hear they're remaking it, though. I think someone brought that up on The Velvet, actually. And Steven, you're excited about the casting on that, I think, but I just hate it.
For me, I think, kind of going back a little bit to what Logan was saying, I think that people, they consume media for all types of different reasons. And, you know, me, I lead a fairly creatively satisfying life, but it's low on drama. So when it comes to like entertainment things, I really like having my buttons pushed, whereas someone else whose life might be a little bit more routine, you know, they might be more into the spectacle of being bitten by a radioactive spider, you know, living in some faraway galaxy or whatnot, which I love those movies too, but, you know, maybe they're more interested, like my parents, they just want to go get away for a couple hours and munch on popcorn or whatnot. But, you know, while I'm in awe of, the craftsmanship of these best films we've been talking about, you know, Touch of Evil or Casablanca or Silence of the Lambs, you know, movies at the same time, they're kind of a comfort food for me. And they do relate to certain, you know, sort of touchstones in my life, like I was asking Logan about. But the ones I've seen the most times, if you count those, is probably shit like Spinal Tap or The Breakfast Club or things like that.
Right.
And talking about that, a friend of mine, she has The Burbs, that early Tom Hanks movie. She leaves that on a constant loop every day as she's doing housework. It's like, I guess, some kind of like routine of normalcy or something. She can latch on to some kind of subconscious rhythm she can tune out or something. I don't know, but she's like psychotic for that movie. But the movies I consider my favorites, kind of along with what Steven was saying, you know, I don't want to be the tastemaker and just say I enjoy the classics and whatnot, but my favorite movies tend to end up being those that kind of bridge those two things of the technical craftsmanship with the emotional power. And those are my favorite movies, things like Amelie, Eternal Sunshine, The Spotless Mind, Magnolia, Old Boy, things like that. And that's sort of where I make the distinction. So moving on to our next topic, we want to talk a little bit about those guilty pleasures, those films we don't necessarily want to claim to love because all the hipsters won't shut up about them. And Steven, we want to bounce that right back to you. Any guilty pleasures in the film world for you?
Definitely, but that hipster thing, that always freaks me out. I saw a dude the other day somewhere, and I wanted to ask him if he was a hipster, but then I didn't realize if hipster was something you call somebody or something you self-identify with.
Hipsters aren't self-aware by nature.
Oh, they aren't? Okay. All right. Yeah, guilty pleasures, man. I'll watch The Last Boy Scout over and over and over, and The Adventures of Ford Fairlane. Is that what it's called? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll watch that's great. You know, Overboard, too, of course. I'll, at the same time, I wouldn't admit that those are poorly made, either. I would admit that they get to be so popular that people consider they have to be trash, but I think they're pretty good, actually, put together very well.
A lot of films, I think, that we consider trash, when you look at them, it took a lot just to get to that level, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
How about you, Jesse?
Yeah, see, I don't know. I kind of have a problem with that term guilty pleasures because, well, if you like it, what's to feel guilty about, you know? And that usually gets thrown around a lot, at least around me with music, you know? Oh, this is my guilty pleasure. It's like, okay, so you like the 10 hippest bands, but you still listen to Def Leppard like I do. It's like, so what's wrong with that?
Does it make you feel weird when one of the things that you love someone else lists as a guilty pleasure and you feel like you're not hip enough maybe?
No, I think I'm actually just stoked that someone else digs it still or at all, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I guess depending on who you talk to, some people I know would say, well, Jennifer's Body must be one of my guilty pleasures. And, of course, yeah. Overboard, I just love Overboard nonstop to death and Ruthless People, but I guess it doesn't really matter to me what anyone else thinks.
When you hear somebody say that their guilty pleasure is your favorite film, then you just, you become aware that they haven't transcended to your level of enlightenment yet, you know?
Casting aside the term guilty pleasure for the moment, are there some of those movies that that you're really into?
You know, I do have some guilty pleasures in the sense of it's very difficult to appear heterosexual when you've had a pint of Miller Lite and you're talking about how awesome it was when you were laughing at Jeremy Piven and John Cusack messing around in Serendipity. It's really hard to it's really hard to be manly when that's going on. So I would say that the guilty pleasure term is valid, at least in some cases with me.
Are there any films for any of you guys that you refuse to watch with anyone else at all? Say, specifically with a woman.
I would say it definitely, A, it depends on the woman. but I would say like something like watching the first 20 minutes of Up. I wouldn't want to. Or maybe I do. I don't know. It depends. If she's into sensitive, then, well, she's going to get it.
Yeah. I love The Notebook. I thought that was a really well-done movie. And I love, you know, Ryan Gosling and everything he does. That's the kind of movie that, yeah, bring the girl over. And we can sit down and watch that together because you're going to get a genuine reaction out of me that's not just me sitting there nodding my head placatingly.
That's Jim Rockford on there, right?
Yeah,
man. I should see that.
Are some of those types of films, movies that you share socially with your friends? You like, does your group of friends there all kind of enjoy the same types of guilty pleasure movies, or are they just yours and yours alone?
It's one of those things to where we all have different ones, but we definitely will enjoy them together, or at least enjoy it to a point. The last time we did that, we were only able to watch like halfway of Breakin'. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't finish it.
When I was a kid, just for some context, I saw that film in the theater.
Yeah, I think I did too. Man, Turbo and everybody, I love
it. Oh my God, yes.
I lasted just because I knew I wanted to see Jean-Claude Van Damme's brief, not even a role. He was just an extra in it. And I just wanted to see him.
Did you do the splits?
No. He was just shimmying around in no discernible fashion.
In the true spirit of the original Breakin' before Electric Boogaloo took it to all new heights.
they really kicked it in gear with Electric Boogaloo.
It's weird that Electric Boogaloo has become sort of the meme default term for any sequel that you want to make fun of, you know?
However, I would say one that's even better, and I know Steven will appreciate this, just anything to Your Sister is a Werewolf.
Hey, you know, talking about movies as a social trick, that's something I never can do. When I watch a movie, it's always by myself on a DVD anyway. I never call anybody over to watch it, and I really have got to where I almost hate watching movies with people because I'm afraid they're going to say something, and then I'm going to hate them for the rest of their life. You know? I can't handle watching a movie with somebody who's saying this is where the guy's in the closet and all that stuff. I just want to knife him in the throat, you know. And
I handle it. I take it you don't go to a lot of racially integrated theaters.
I usually go to the matinee. I'm the first one there, and usually the only one there, man. But I saw a movie with Jesse, and he didn't say anything, which I like, you know. We saw Friday the 13th together, I think.
The new reboot.
Yeah, the reboot.
Yeah, I don't like the talking during the film. I hate that going to the theater where people do that. And when you even politely ask them to not talk on their phone or something, they get mad at you. And I just think, okay, what?
I feel the same way. Like, movie watching for me is not a social experience. And it kind of evolved. When I was in high school and stuff, that's what you did. But now my friend's film taste, I have one friend that I can go to the movies with who likes the same kind of stuff I do, but... I mean, for the most part, guilty pleasures for me are things like Kevin Smith movies. I mean,
really?
Yeah. I mean, all the characters talk the same way, and they're not going to win any cinematography awards or anything like that. But there's something about the guy's stuff that to me is just relatable and sort of an everyman quality and lots of dick and fart jokes and stuff that I still find funny. But
well, I didn't mean really as in really you watched that. I mean, really, you're actually guilty about that? Because I would proclaim that from the heavens. Yeah, I watch Kevin Smith.
Yeah, I'm guilty of it in a film critic sort of way, but no, I do love his movies. It's just I think some people would consider that a guilty pleasure. But then the guy turns around and he goes and he makes Chasing Amy, which is one of my all-time guilt-free favorite movies, and did it for $250 grand. I'd like to see a lot more movies like that. Mm-hmm. You got things like Showgirls. I cannot count how many times I've been watching Showgirls. And, you know, the next morning I'm on some early morning video shoot and find myself nodding off because that fucker came on at like midnight and I just couldn't look away. You know, she's all flailing and doesn't want to help. That's a really good example. It's probably a divergent topic, but that's a really good example of a movie that doesn't work because the protagonist is unlikable. I mean, there's nothing redeeming about her, but yet I can't look away. And then another one, just more recently, I bet I've seen like 2/3 of the movie Rockstar probably about 20 times because it's just on constantly on HBO and every East, West, Central, Bolivian channel, whatever. But one of my best friends actually lives down the road from me. He's a musician, and his youngest daughter, one of her first phrases that she ever spoke was, "Stand up and shout!" Much to the dismay of her mother. How about some films that maybe are not guilty pleasures, but things that are underrated to you? Like for me, like the movie Wreck, R-E-C, that thing scared the hell out of me. And, you know, it's not necessarily much to look at, but like the last 20 minutes are absolutely, you know, seat clenchingly engaging. You know, people talk about A Very Long Engagement. That's a movie that people don't talk about very much, even though it's made by the same guy that made Amelie and Delicatessen and some of my favorite films. But that one kind of slipped through the cracks somehow. I don't know if the title, Very Long Engagement, they got that mixed up with, you know, Limited Engagement or Special Engagement at the cinema or whatever. But I think that's a pretty good film. And any underrated gems in you guys' collection?
Oh, yeah, lots of them.
Yeah. For me, the biggest one is Spartan by the David Mamet directed film. And I really believe that the reason why it didn't really get as much traction in a theatrical release as it did is because their trailer was dog shit. It was awful. It pushed Ed O'Neill to the forefront of the movie where they made him look like he was this really big part of the movie, and he's in it for probably a total of 5 minutes. And it was like similar to Godsend and Robert De Niro. He was barely in it, and he did it as a favor to a friend, and now he's, you know, all over the place in the promotions for it. But it was just a very, very thoughtful and intense political thriller. I feel it didn't have the traction that it really deserved.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be tons of them. Things I'll just constantly see, and a lot of them I even rewatch, and I think, God, why isn't everyone else obsessed with this or talking about it? You know, why hasn't this DVD been swiped from the video shop yet? Like Psycho Beach Party, I think, didn't get it the attention it deserved.
Oh, yeah. That's a cult classic.
Yeah, that's great.
See, no one ever talks about it except probably you guys. Like, no one's like, oh, I've never even heard that, what that is. But maybe the most underrated film, and it's also because it's one of my personal favorites, is New Waterford Girl, this Canadian film from the late 90s. It's about a 15-year-old girl named Mooney Potty who wants to go to an art school. New Waterford is just a seacoast shit town out by Cape Breton, you know, on the east coast of Canada. And it's just, this is the 1970s, nothing but coal mines. So she gets a scholarship to a school in New York. It's all paid for and everything, but of course her folks won't let her go. So she devises a plan to pretend to be pregnant, so they have to send her away to supposedly have the baby. And instead of going to this place called Anakinish to have the kid incognito, she's just going to go to New York to the arts high. And it all works out in the end very beautifully.
Yeah, one Jesse turned me on to, All the Boys Love Mandy Lane. It's an amazingly good slasher, I think. Just didn't get any kind of release. They used some sort of golden tint on that whole movie. It's so cool. I like it a lot. Cry Wolf also didn't get any attention. People kind of hated it because it was kind of a hybrid between a psychological thriller and a slasher. People resist it, but it was really a vital movie, I think. Henry Fool, I love that movie. Y'all seen Henry Fool?
Yes, yeah.
I don't understand why people watch stupid stuff like Forrest Gump when there's stuff like Henry Fool out there. It just totally amazes me. Jack the Bear, you remember Jack the Bear?
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yeah, I love that movie. I think that movie is very, very quality. It's got emotional punch that few other movies have. And nobody talks about it. Every time I mention it, everybody just kind of goes dial tone, you know?
Moving over to the TV side of that a little bit, I used to watch Nip Tuck for reasons that I just cannot understand. Same thing with Dirty Sexy Money. I used to watch that too. And, you know, I usually pride myself on being at least fairly tasteful when it comes to TV watching, because I don't have a lot of time, so I DVR everything in time shift. But those shows were both so bad and cliched that I'd actually convince myself that they were like, you know, satires of superficiality, which I don't think the writers had quite that much foresight. But Steven, do you watch much trash TV or anything that any...
Closest I've come to trash TV, I think, would be Saving Grace. It's over now, but I watched the whole series, like, what, 3 seasons, 4 seasons, something like that.
Wow.
And I realized after about 3 or 4 episodes that it was not what I wanted to watch. But nevertheless, I stayed in. And the final episode actually had some punch. It worked. It made the whole series kind of come together. But yeah, and like Logan, I think I remember Logan saying on the Velvet somewhere that he stuck with 24, and I did too. You know, even when it got, even when it went over the top stupid with mountain lions and just so many, it was like kids were writing it or something. But
Yeah,
but it was fun, you know?
Moment to moment with Kiefer Sutherland, he was just always so riveting whenever he was on the screen, and you didn't care how stupid the whole plot was because he's just so damn good.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe Ugly Americans counts as trash, or The Good Guys. I love both of them. I love USA stuff. I love Psych, White Collar.
White Collar.
Yeah, Burn Notice. I'm addicted to Burn Notice. Oh, I watch a lot of Magnum P.I. I don't know if that counts as trash TV.
A little bit. Is that what time is that on? Is that like 2 a.m. mountain time?
I just DVR it. I don't even know when it comes on, actually. Yeah, I'll watch Magnum P.I. any episode over and over, and I'll watch Star Trek Next Generation over and over and over, but I'd never call STNG trash, you know?
Right, of course.
There is always the fact that I've seen that episode like 6 times, you know? I'll watch it again.
Shifting gears a little bit, we all know that, you know, talking about influences and whatnot, that you can pick up just about anything from the Criterion Collection, and you know it's going to rock. For those who don't know, Criterion, they're the ones who do all those re-releases with the loving restorations and the posthumous commentary tracks and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of the classical material that writers and directors certainly draw a lot of their inspiration from, and rightly so. But I was wondering if you guys wanted to make a case for why you think today's screenwriters and directors should broaden their horizons a little bit and maybe seek out more genre-type fare.
Well, right now, especially with television, a lot of genre fare has been able to get a little deeper. I mean, you look at White Collar, and that is nothing but a crime caper show. That's all it is. Well, in the sense of, you know, the criminal is taking down other criminals. But even though it's not the deepest premise, they allow these characters to breathe. They allow them to be flawed, and sometimes things aren't, you know, they don't tie up nicely in the end. And I think with a lot of genre fare out today, you know, the Departed is just a straight up genre film that Scorsese did, and it was fantastic, and it won the Oscar. Nowadays, especially with the advent of the internet, and people are realizing that there's a lot of depth to the genre, and it reminds me of a quote that Jack White, of all people, said. The reason why he creates so many different bands is that each band has its own restriction, because without restrictions, he loses his creativity. And I feel like, you know, with the working within the genre convention, whatever that genre may be, there's a lot of creativity to happen there, because you do have restrictions as far as what people are expecting, as far as what the conventions are, and where you can break them and where you can't. And I think as far as screenwriters go and television writers, going into more genre fare is the place to be right now.
I know Steven kind of dealt with that quite a bit in Demon Theory, that whole genre as mnemonic device that I love so much, sort of that shorthand that you get when you've watched so much genre content, that you kind of, you know, it's like, okay, here are these 10 sets of rules, and you already know this stuff, so let's just get down to the story at this point.
Yeah, genre does work like that, and I agree totally with Logan that if you're as a writer, if you're crossing a room, if you make yourself have to walk between these two lines, then you're gonna really find out what you can do as a writer. Whereas if you can go all over the room, then you're just gonna wander around and be literary and boring, I think. But I think that the reason genre is hot is because possibly that the audience is figuring out they don't want to go to a theater or a book to look deeper into their own lives. They want to go somewhere else, and genre tends to take you somewhere else, and you find out that it really is deeper into yourself, but you're kind of tricked into getting there.
I'd really like to see a bit of both, and this made me think of two things that happened at this year's literary conference, AWP. One is something you once said, Stephen, that you went to grad school to steal all the pretty sentences, smuggle them back to genre writing.
Yep.
So that's kind of looking at it that way, except with film. And something another author, Todd Goldberg, said, how The Great Gatsby, this great literary novel, is actually about a gangster, a rube, and a femme fatale. And it's kind of like what Logan was saying about how this is just essentially this. So I don't see why you can't have both. I mean, yeah, you should be watching more than the Criterion Collection, but I think if you want to do anything in film, really want to do it, you should go over a little bit of everything. It seems so many people these days, unless it was made within the past 5 to 10 years, it doesn't exist to them, which I guess for me, it just doesn't make sense in my mind to ignore everything.
I agree. You know, I think musicians are a lot better about that. You can probably answer this better than I can, Gordon, but whenever I see musicians, they know everything about every band for the past 30 years in all genres, and it always just so amazes me. But I find that's not the case with moviegoers or readers. They read in a very narrow part of the shelf, and they stay there, and they write stuff that's really going to belong on that shelf if they write anything, I guess. And it's typically way too influenced by what they're reading and quite boring.
I think that stuff is kind of encouraged in music, especially these days. It used to be more, if you think of music as genre, the musical genres used to be more well-defined, and these days it's almost like the more cross-pollination you can do, the better. But I think one of the lessons people might take from more genre-type the content creating, that is that it just pays the bills. I mean, that's where the majority of the work is, just talking numbers. And my own friends who work in the industry, and I make videos for a living, I'm sort of on the periphery there in the filmmaking business, I guess, but most of my friends who do this kind of stuff, they're DPs and they're sound men and makeup artists and, you know, gaffers and stuff like that. And writer-director, that's the role that everybody always sees and kind of the thing that they're drawn to. But for every one of those people, there's like 30, 50 crew people, and they couldn't, you know, working on a Martin Lawrence movie is the same thing to them as being on the Chris Nolan movie. You know, it's 8 to 12 weeks of employment. And I like to see those people employed, and genre stuff does that. But, and I was watching, there's this excellent series called, I think it's called the Dialogue series. It's all very, very in-depth interviews with screenwriters on DVD. And one of those guys made a great point. I don't think any screenwriters ever sit down and they choose deliberately to churn out like marginal formulaic crap. You know, even with that kind of material, I think they start out with higher aspirations and they're really giving credit for it. And the studio brings in collaborators and script doctors and, you know, all these uncredited rewriters and whatnot. And it turns into sort of this design by committee, LCD, lowest common denominator type thing. But really, you know, they those things do make it appeal to more people, for better or worse. And, you know, stockholders are happy, and then they get to work on another project. You know, the cycle, the machinery continues.
Yeah, exactly. It's like what Michael Chabon said at the AWP keynote address. His goal was always to do art for money, and I think he's a good writer to look at because he does play in the non-literary fields, as they're called, I guess, the genre commercial fields, and he does wonderful in them. And he's reaching so much more of an audience than people who are sticking to boring stories.
I believe his exact quote, I was in the room there with you, and they asked him why he wrote, and he said, "The Benjamins."
Yeah.
In his inimitable style.
Yeah.
Well, talking about sort of like the creative control of the auteur and whatnot, obviously, you know, media distribution channels and models or whatnot, they're changing across the board, and film's not immune to that. You've got discs by mail, streaming, on demand. They're testing out the whole simultaneous theatrical home release thing. Actually, my buddy was talking to me at work this morning. about the new Rush documentary, the band, the Canadian rock trio.
Yeah.
And he said he had to drive across town to see it last weekend at some theater. It was the only place in town that was showing it. And I told him I saw it on cable last weekend. They did one of the simultaneous release things. And they he didn't believe me, which I thought was really cool. I know HDNet's doing some stuff like that with Magnolia Pictures too.
Yeah.
But you know, you've got YouTube and stuff like that for sort of the smaller format things. But how do you guys see that, you know, these new delivery and technology mechanisms changing the content itself, the type of entertainment that actually gets created?
I think it's something that really needs to be embraced. You shouldn't ignore anything that could potentially benefit what it is you're trying to do and just get your story out to the widest possible audience. I mean, that's what it's all about, isn't it? You know, yeah, everyone wants to make money, but I don't know, it's the idea that films are meant to be seen and books are meant to be read. So unless you don't want people to see your film, you know, why would you say, oh, I'm never going to do that? And you look at all these technological things we have now. If someone really wants to watch an entire feature film on something the size of an iPhone, well, why not let them then?
Yeah.
So these like changing distribution methods, Stephen, do you see that changing the type of content you might create?
Well, not that I would create. I'm not doing films, but I would hope that it would lead to more seat of your pants filmmaking. Like with you had Dostoevsky and Dickens doing stuff just to pay their bills every month, and I would like to see more of that in film. More of the I have to make this film and make it good, or I'm not going to eat dinner tonight. You know, and I think you know one out of 30 movies like that might just blow us away. The rest will be crap, but we'll probably see them anyways.
Are you saying filmmakers should get paid by the minute like they used to get paid by the word?
I think that would help a lot.
Hey, screw you guys. I like my unions, you dicks.
Do you see the vehicle of distribution changing the type of content that people create?
I'm not entirely certain. It's definitely going to be interesting, especially nowadays with distribution methods. We're seeing televisions having things like YouTube and Netflix integrated into the TV, and you know for the web series industry, that's a huge boost, and it obviously won't be boosting that industry for another 4 or 5 years until that functionality reaches ubiquity. I think right now, as far as distribution methods after theatrical releases for films in particular, right now it's going to get a lot better and simultaneously a lot worse. Blockbuster just got got knocked off the New York Stock Exchange.
Wow!
So they're on their way out. Hollywood Video has been closing up stores left and right.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Netflix is exploding. And so there's a lot of stuff that you'd be able to watch on Netflix that you wouldn't normally be able to watch anywhere just because of the instant watch streaming. So there's a whole bunch of documentaries that you would, get to watch that you never would in a million years be able to see. But then there's also Redbox that is taking a bit of Netflix's market share. Yet all they release are, the latest released films. So it's getting bigger and smaller, and it really depends on who ends up, earning more market share in the marketplace when places like Blockbuster and Hollywood Video finally kick the bucket.
Yeah, at my day job, I work on the sort of the bleeding edge of a lot of this kind of stuff. I have an audience for most of the things I create on any given day. I have an audience of about 50,000 or so that are watching it. They're all from different parts of the world, and they all have different methods of connecting to the content, so I have to kind of create different versions that maximize their experience for that at the expense of the content. So it hits me pretty hard, this whole thing. But knowing about that affects how I create the content. So like if I know such and such only has a 200 kilobit per second connection, I'm keeping the frame size really small.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more close-ups and there's fewer cuts in general. And
a lot less movement.
Yeah. I don't want to, distract the compression scheme and the frame, but the big dumb graphics and things like that. So, and those limitations, they affect the end user's perception of the content, but also maybe, a little bit more disturbingly, they affect my creation of the content itself. It kind of, it's like shrinking my palette of storytelling tools. But I think, creative people have been hampered by their mediums, whatever they work in from, the dawn of art. But personally, in this whole thing, I'd kind of like to see it go to sort of like a, I guess the word is cloud, like a cloud-based model. You create once, publish anywhere, you've got sort of the content up there, and whatever you're watching it on, it detects what kind of server you have, and it sends the small or the large video and your bit rate and all that kind of stuff. But I think something that some people have to kind of get away from and let go of a little bit is this idea of possession, like possessing the media itself. You download the file to your drive and you have it and you own it. I think they have to let go of that a little bit, so you can watch it on any device you own at any time. And personally, I don't really mind paying for content specifically. I don't think we're at a point yet where it would have to be so good that I could totally sever my cable bill and my cable connection so that I could buy the content on demand or the monthly fees or whatnot. But I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think that's the direction that it's going. How do you guys consume most of the content that you guys watch? What location or device do you guys use? We'll start with Steven.
Mostly DVD, almost exclusively DVD, I guess. Every once and again, I'll watch something on my computer screen, but very, very rarely. And I never watch any movies on my iPhone. That drive me insane, I think. The computer for me is a place to work, not to play, and the TV is a place to play, not to work.
That's exactly how I feel. I spend all day in front of the computer, so I don't like watching. You know, I love seeing dudes get hit in the nuts on YouTube as much as the next blow. But you know, I can only watch things at about 10 minutes at a clip on the computer. So I go into my living room, my nice comfy sofa, my 55-inch HD TV, and that's time. You know, entertain me.
Yeah.
How about you, Jesse? Where do you watch most of your content?
Yeah, it's all DVD, of course. Well, that also means video cassette.
What is this video cassette you speak of?
I'll never give up my VCR, and I have things on video cassette that aren't on DVD, will never be on DVD, and certainly will not be on Blu-ray. And I even have DVDs that'll probably never hit Blu-ray. So,
how about Laserdisc? You have the Laserdisc?
No, I don't, but I... See, some of that stuff ends up on DVD somehow, you know, by someone's hands, so yeah. I don't have to have Laserdisc to get that uncut Scream or anything.
Logan, I know you're a really big fan of web series and stuff like that. Can you talk a little bit about that and what gets you going about those things?
Well, right now, it's definitely a growing industry. We're starting to see a lot of studios that are starting to jump in there. Sony now has a new media division. MTV is jumping into it. And, you know, to MTV's credit, they're looking for actual scripted drama and comedies as opposed to Jersey Shore on the web. But with web, it's this weird combination of being able to experiment with this medium that is... as far as what you can do is limitless, simply because you know there are no standards and practices, and that, God willing, there never will be. But it's a mix of that experimental type of storytelling with the reality of making a production and wanting to continue making a production, and so you have to be able to sell it. So you can do weird David Lynchian stuff all you want, but if an advertiser doesn't want to touch it, you're not going to be doing it for very long. So it's trying to take people trying to break the conventions of filmmaking, TV, and just that sort of typical structure, and somehow marrying it to commercialism, I guess is the best way to put it, even though that's kind of a loaded word. But it's that weird gray area. And there's a lot of good stuff going on. The signal to noise ratio is shit right now, but it's getting better. And there are a lot of good shows out there that are picking up traction and doing things that you wouldn't see on TV just because it's not marketable. Not for TV, but it is on the web.
I would agree with most of that. It is getting better, and it's a very democratized sort of medium. But how many you still have to attract your own audience and whatnot, and some things slip through the cracks and whatnot. But the one thing I haven't gotten totally on board yet with it, because most of the production value isn't there on some of them.
Yeah.
It needs to, for me, the show has to be completely transparent. If it distracts me, at least in a little bit, my sense of disbelief, my suspension of disbelief is shot. But I do like the idea of sort of the miniaturist, I guess, entertainment, you call it, in little webisodes and whatnot. I like that sort of bite size idea. But as long as they have professionals creating it. Like, there's that Funny or Die TV show they ported from the web onto HBO, which was really cool. They took the web snippets and put on there, but all the clips that made the show were the ones that were professionally produced. So, Any of you guys excited about 3D TV in the home?
No.
No.
No. Not at all.
Yeah.
Good. We can skip that topic. Next.
Thank God.
You know, in TV, shifting gears here a little bit, reality programming is kind of, you know, it took over for a while there and because it was cheap to produce, obviously had huge numbers. But I think we're starting to see the return to more kind of, you know, scripted content now. Like Logan stated so eloquently in the preliminary thread we had for this, TV is fucking awesome right now. And I'd personally have to agree with that.
Yeah,
and let's start with Logan. What do you think about it that's so awesome?
Oh, God. Well, the mere fact that Breaking Bad exists to me is a miracle and affirms my belief that we live in a just and wonderful universe where there is a loving and just God.
Having a heroin-addicted protagonist?
Yeah, and to have it actually make more than one season, much less two, much less three. And so that show in and of itself is just amazing and something that you wouldn't even have seen even be pitched in the last 10 years. And well, the mere fact that Lost lasted as long as it did and existed for as long as it did. God, Mad Men, The Wire went five seasons. The Wire went five seasons. I am shocked it went one.
I know.
Or how you've got the hero of one show is actually a killer himself, you know.
Yeah.
So this is all right. I mean, true, it, you know, he's taking out people that no one cares for anyway, but still, I mean, come on, he himself is a serial killer. And we love this.
Yeah.
See, I don't know, I'm still behind on my TV viewing. I've not seen The Wire yet, and God, I'm probably the only one here, right?
That's, you know what drives me crazy about that is I held off on that, and the show is not in widescreen, and I've been wanting to buy the whole collection and watch it on my TV, and it drives me crazy because I've got an HD set, and I'd have to pillar box the entire thing, all five seasons, and I can't bring myself to do that, but I do want to watch it someday.
Well, it's not in widescreen?
No, they shot it deliberately in 4:3 because they thought it more represented like the reality of vision or whatnot.
Oh, that doesn't matter to me, I guess. I mean, the ratio is not all important. Besides, I thought The Mighty Boosh was probably not in widescreen, too, and I just love that show to death.
How about you, Steven? Do you see a resurgence in quality television? Hopefully now the reality craze might be waning a bit.
I do, yes. I'm not sure it's due to some tailing off of the reality scene, though. I think it's that there's more fish in the water, so the fish have to be bigger and badder. Last year, used to you had the three networks, you know, CBS, ABC, NBC doing stuff, so you were really limited. But now, you know, HBO, Showtime, USA, TNT, everybody's got a series and they've got good series, and it's the marketplace and it's raising the quality of things, I think. But I'm like Jesse, I've yet to see The Wire, I've yet to see hardly any of the series that people talk about so big, but I've seen all the Futuramas,
which is back, by the way.
Yeah,
it is Thursday nights. Yeah, I love all those, you know, the pay cable network shows. I love them because I don't think they're hampered by ratings and whatnot. Granted, they need ratings to get new subscribers, but week to week, you know, they're not driven by sort of that spectacle, and you get a lot, I think, more better storytelling and such.
Was the first of those Outer Limits? Yeah, and that was a pretty quality series, or a reboot of the series anyways, I thought. And now we got everything good, evidently.
Logan mentioned Mad Men, and that's one I love talking about because they're on sort of basic cable or the next tier of cable, whatever you call it, or AMC. Was it AMC?
Yeah, it's AMC.
Okay. It seems like they're breaking a lot of conventions in their storytelling, which I love. They have sort of weird structure in the stories, and the act breaks are in kind of odd places, and they don't seem to be afraid to like really kind of throw their characters into, you know, upheaval and really shock us. It reminds me, actually, the storytelling reminds me a lot of The Sopranos. It's just sort of like anything goes. And then we have Archer. That's an animated show on FX.
Archer.
Yeah, it's like you could take The Office and slam it together with James Bond and animate it, and it's filthy and it's hilarious, and I love it. And I'm so glad that kind of stuff is on TV. I think it's on FX, and they're allowed to curse a little bit after 9 o'clock or whatever the rule is there.
Well, the way I explain the premise for Archer is if you think about it, James Bond is really kind of a dick. And Archer, they just make him an actual dick. He's very competent at his job, but he's just a raging asshole.
Yeah.
And that I love just that whole premise. And the execution is always pitch perfect.
They've got the mother from Arrested Development on there. She kind of runs the spy organization. And she's hilarious. On our next topic, I don't have a lot to contribute to this one because when it comes to writing for television specifically, I've only done like commercials and stuff like that and not actual programming or drama or anything like that. But I imagine Logan probably has some things to say on the matter of teleplays versus writing screenplays. Any insight as to the difference there and what things people might look for there?
Well, predominantly, I mean, the biggest part about the difference between a teleplay and a screenplay is the structure of it. There are a finite number of ways that you could write a teleplay, and it depends on whether you're writing a 1-hour drama or a 30-minute single camera sitcom or a 30-minute multi-camera sitcom. But the let's just say, just for sake of argument, for the 1-hour drama, nowadays it's shifting toward what's called a 6-act structure, where your cold open is a certain amount of pages, and you have each act end is when commercials are supposed to hit. And I think as far as teleplays, it's very, very structured. In at a certain point in the script, you have to be done, and you have to have a clean break into commercial, or the whole story is just going to fall apart. And I think with screenplays, you have you can get done in anywhere from 110 to 100 to 120 pages, and you're solid, as long as your pacing is something that would actually create a good movie. TV writing is way more structured, and again, it goes back to that idea of restrictions allowing you to be a little more creative. And for me, that's why I really love writing TV scripts, is because I'm forced to make decisions, because I have to get this, I have to get out in 60 pages. And if I'm not out in 60 pages, I'm screwed.
I know you've done a lot of specs for TV shows before. How much research do you do on those things, as far as getting into the lead and supporting character psychology, as far as reviewing their past scripts that exist online, stuff like that?
I did, when I was first writing specs, I did that. I live in Hollywood, and so we have the Writers Guild of America. They have a library that you go to, and it's open to the public, and they just have a whole shitload of scripts, TV, film, you name it, they've got it. And when I wrote my first one for Burn Notice, even though I had seen every episode of Burn Notice probably twice, I still went out because I wanted to understand the format of how it was written. Because each show, depending on the creator, they have their own style as to how in-depth you get in the action tags, the pacing of the dialogue, and how things are doled out. And like specifically with Lost, rated R language is all across the dialogue. And then when they actually go to shoot, that's when they cut it out, but they want the actors to read it, so they understand the mentality that they need to be in, and then they adjust the language accordingly for ABC. I really did a lot of research at first, and then when I started writing more, I would usually just pick up one script and read through it just to understand the format, and then after that point, I got it, and I just go from there.
You think that's why some of the television characters tend to have less complexity, maybe because of that need to fit that character into 20 different episode adventures per season?
I don't know if I would even say less complex, because they in the long run, you actually have more time with them. I mean, you look at Jack on Lost. I mean, he really evolved as a person over the course of a number of seasons, and he was a different person by the end of the show, and he was like five different people by the end of the show. The way I look at it with film in particular, I see that more as a medium of moments. Like, for example, I know by heart the shootout scene of Heat. I cannot for the life of me remember what Al Pacino's character name was in it.
Right.
And in Lost, I know all the character names because I've lived with them for so long. And the great shows are all about the people and all about the characters. And, at first in the pilot, these characters may not be fully fleshed out. But over the course of a season, because you get to spend more time with them, each episode you kind of get to explore a little different part of their psyche. And for someone who devotes the time for an entire season, it pays off because they learn more about this person each and every episode.
You tend to see some series grow like that, like they're somewhat simple the first season, and then they bring in more complexity once they realize the series is going to have longer legs. And I think a lot of series maybe aren't as complex to begin with, to my original point, maybe because, you know, they're on a shorter leash or whatnot. But
I prefer that shorter leash so much. Like on Lost, I love that pilot of Lost, but then when it started going to everybody's story, I was completely bored because deep characters are great, but I like to see characters through their actions rather than through having their backstory flayed away. Like that. But Logan got it just right. The difference in writing for the big screen and writing for TV, it's the difference in writing a comic book script and a graphic novel script. In a comic book script, you have to allow pages for ads, you know, so you've got to time everything accordingly. And in a graphic novel, you can do whatever you want.
I haven't read any television scripts, which I should probably look into that and try and do it, but I just read as many film scripts as I can get my hands on. And sometimes they get confusing. It seems like they don't know the rules anymore. You hear one person or one professor or even someone from a studio in a screenwriting magazine say, oh, we're not doing caps anymore except to introduce characters. But then you'll read 20 scripts where caps pop up left and right.
Right.
And also, I guess, a lot of it's opinion, but things that really, really bug me, and I just think for a film that has been made, and you just get to read the script before the film finds the theater because some of those things hit the internet a lot of times. When I see something in the script such as "we see," I can't stand seeing the words "we see" written in a script. I mean, you're not showing, which is what they always say, show, don't tell.
Yeah, mine are camera angles. When I see camera angles written in a script, that drives me crazy. That's the director's decision.
Yeah.
But you can hint at that, though. There are little tricks you can do.
Oh, yeah.
Like you just say, a phone. It's like, well, it's obviously got to be close enough on the phone for it to be a shot of the phone. So you can kind of sneak your way in there a little bit without actually – it's that psychology of messing with the director a little bit, you know?
You know, of course, with putting, you know, camera angles in a script, you know, if you're David Mamet or Quentin Tarantino, you can do that because you're shooting the script.
Yeah.
And so you get away with that. And that's why, like, Inglourious Basterds was, what, 300 frickin' pages long?
Right. There were notes to self, you know?
Yeah.
I think the trick is the formatting doesn't matter. If you make the story compelling enough, whoever is reading it will just not care about all caps or "we see" or anything like that. They'll just want to get to the next page, and that's how you got to write it, I think.
The studio readers will find 1,000 different reasons to hate you and everything that you stand for because they're readers and they're not writing. So when you send in a script with things that break convention like "we see" or all caps, it's always going to be a crapshoot on whether or not they like that, whether or not they hate that, or if you don't put it in, whether they like that, whether or not they hate that. Yeah. It's just it's constantly a no-win situation. But, you know, we do it because we don't really know how to do anything else, and we can't do basic math, so options are limited.
Hey, throwing this back to you, Jesse, do you think that having a formal education in journalism or some kind of English background is helpful when it comes to writing for these more visual-type mediums?
I think a little bit both ways, yes and no. Screenplay, you don't really want it to be strictly pose-like, the way a passage you'd find in a novel. But then at the same time, when you're having to direct without direction in a script, some of that's really nice if you, you know, use, well, semicolons and stuff, and just say something that its meaning is so obvious. It streamlines the writing of an action sequence or just anything when you say, "And then he shot him a look, au contraire." It's you're saying exactly what that look means without necessarily spelling it out and giving camera directions or saying he's looking at him and thinking this because of this, if that makes sense.
A lot of prose authors are used to sort of that, all that inner monologue they've for so long relied upon to develop their characters and stuff like that. But like with cinema, all these visual mediums we're talking about, it's the ultimate exercise of show versus tell that we talk about. Do you understand how to sequence images in a way psychologically that tells a story? Do you understand like montage and cross cutting? And you kind of like we were talking about before, you learn to look for more, you know, visual cues that do what we call externalizing the internal sort of workaround for that. Like there'll be a shot of like a person's face in a rain streaked window, you know, to show their sadness or whatnot, or they'll be like the quarterback on his way to the big game, and he's a tiny little figure in the massiveness of the empty stadium that illustrates his sort of insecurity, you know, shit like that. I've said before that I think a graphic designer probably has a better chance of writing a good script than a journalist, because it's about being able to learn to communicate using just the senses of sight and sound.
I don't know if I'd go that far as to say a graphic designer could do better, but I think they definitely have some tools that the people with a prose background don't have. I do think people who are novelists or short story writers and come to screenplay writing are very much handicapped, because they don't know how to do things visually often. They know how to do it in words and sentences, but they don't know how to do it visually. So they need to have that graphic designer brain and the story brain, I think. I do think a journalism background is great. In journalism, you learn to get to the point immediately, and so many writers don't understand that.
Yeah, in journalism, they teach you that inverted triangle thing where like each line is less important than the previous. Yeah. You can stop reading at any point and feel like you got the point of the story.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you have an English, you know, a background in some sort of English or literature, then you've been taught to pay attention to these tensions in the text, and hopefully you have the ability to manipulate those tensions in your own writing. I would hope. So, I'm like Jesse. Yes and no, I guess.
I definitely agree with Stephen as far as the get to the point aspect of a journalism degree. Or just a journalism background. The other thing is for print journalism, I would say that helps out immensely, in the sense of, you know, you're walking, you know, the crime beat, and you go and you get interviews, and you are trying to see this, you know, this event, whatever it may be, and recreating it in written form in the most entertaining and no bullshit manner possible. And that, at its core, is what screenwriting is creating something that is very entertaining, that is very potent and poignant, and doing it in such a way that executives and readers and people who read thousands and thousands of pages a day can see it get to the point and be affected by it. And I think a journalism degree or just a journalism background definitely assists with that. And I mean, look at, you know, this year, Hurt Locker, the screenwriter, won the all the awards, and he was a journalist for Playboy.
Yes. Huh. What about adaptations? When you take a beloved novel and you script it for the big screen, Stephen, has any of your work been optioned? Any experience with that?
No, it's come close, but no. But I do think novelists are usually the absolute worst to adapt their stuff to the screen, because it all matters to them, you know. I mean, the screenwriter has to be brutal and cold and feelingless, and he or she has to just force this novel into the proper structure for the screen, and that's going to entail changing everything and throwing so much stuff away and adding things that never would have been there. Novels don't work on screen, I don't think. They work on the page.
Are there positive and or negative examples that you've seen of adaptations that come to mind immediately?
One I saw today, it's adapted from a TV series, The Last Airbender. I thought that was a wonderful adaptation. He took, 61 episodes and crammed it into, he didn't cram it all into 1 hour and 3 minutes. Shyamalan didn't, but he crammed probably 20 episodes into 1 hour and 3 minutes, and it was, I was really, really impressed. It's very hard to do. I think Fight Club transferred to the screen really well. That's kind of a meaningless statement, I know, because everybody agrees.
Yeah, a lot of people would argue it was even an improvement.
Yeah. Yeah,
actually, Chuck would argue that when they interviewed him later, he was saying when he saw the ending, his first thought was, fuck, why didn't I think of that?
Oh, man. But see, the adapter has the benefit of the hindsight. You know, he doesn't have to go through all the growing pains that the novelist goes through. He can see it objectively from a distance and can sort of transpose his own interpretation on top of that.
Yeah, but like American Psycho, when it went to the screen, I thought that was terrible and embarrassing and insulting to the book, because it changed everything. And maybe it's just that I'm too loyal to the book or something like that.
The show Justified, actually, has gotten a lot of love on the Velvet. That actually was from an Elmore Leonard short story, and they turned it into a TV series. And I think pretty much they did that, I'm guessing, just on the strength of the central character itself, because he's – you know, they did, I don't know, 13 episodes or however many they did and it was a short story. And basically, you've got it's a federal marshal. He's got the 10-gallon hat and the BlackBerry, you know, sort of his thing. And there's no black hats, no white hats. Everybody's flawed and shades of gray and all that kind of stuff that I love. But the thing I love about the character, he's just a down home guy. You know, he just as soon, you know, talk the bad guy down with a fried chicken leg and a snort of whiskey than he would pull his Glock out on him.
Yeah,
and I really love that. And then you've also got adaptation always comes to mind for some reason because it's just so unusual that the film and the adaptation of the screenplay adaptation, it's the best script that I've ever read. It's a total mind fuck that, you know, I was happy to see it on screen because I could not see it filmed in my head when I got a hold of the script like 9 months before it went to production. I was like, how are they ever going to shoot this? But it really puts you in that process of adaptation, like sort of in a metafictional way, the way they created that. And of course, they also use adaptation as a metaphor for, you know, the humanity of adaptation and Mother Nature's adaptation and whatnot.
It's a Charlie Kaufman script. That's all I've got. Mind fuck. That's just Charlie Kaufman. It was a very, very well done film. And I think it definitely benefited from Nicolas Cage's special brand of insanity.
That's going on his tombstone.
Yes. Oh, no, it's not going on his tombstone. It's going on his pyramid.
Is he going to be buried like next to Elvis or something? He's already bought that plot at Grace.
No, he's got his own island. He owns his own island with pyramids on it. This is not a joke.
You sure the bank didn't seize that one, though?
Yeah. Any memorable adaptations stick out in your mind from book to screen?
I really did enjoy Rules of Attraction. I thought that was a very faithful adaptation, and you know, as far as faithful, I think No Country for Old Men's the most faithful without a direct translation like Sin City. But Rules of Attraction really got the voice of Ellis and the tone of the story and the right beats down and these interrelated characters and got it down to where at its heart. It was Rules of Attraction, and I think that's what you have to aspire to whenever you're trying to adapt another a longer piece of fiction into film. If you remain faithful to that, you're going to create a good movie that will keep fans of the novel happy.
I really agree with that, and I think he nailed the tone. Yeah. I read an interview with Ellis, and he said that's his favorite of his adaptations as well.
You know, my favorite adaptation of all, I think, would be Holes. That was a beautiful novel, and the movie was just as beautiful. I thought the movie was much like No Country for Old Men. It was very, very faithful to the way the story moved, but it just did it all, I think.
No Country, like Logan said, is one of the most faithful, and it's very good. And I've always just terribly loved Jesus' Son, which is also an incredibly faithful adaptation, which I'm going to assume the majority of people would say the same thing about adaptations, is that the best ones are the most faithful ones. Is it's like, well, if you want to change, I mean, you're going to have to change things most likely, but if you have to change what ends up being pretty much the whole thing, what was the point of even adapting that in the first place?
Yeah, just to port the audience over, huh?
I mean, it's like, say you read something and you can picture it in your head and then all you have to do is edit it and make it visual and make it fit into a script format, maybe something like that. It's like you really need to keep that heart of it. And otherwise, if you're just going to say, oh, I like the premise of that novel, you know, it's about this guy doing this to that guy. Well, then why even have it be an adaptation or be that film and name? Why not just create your own story with the same premise?
Because that's how you get studio execs to sell it.
Yeah. Right.
You know, Marathon Man is a movie that is very faithful to the book, too. The book reads so exciting, and the movie is the same thing, you know? And did Goldman write the screenplay also for that? Yeah, no?
I'm not sure.
Okay, I bet he did. He's an amazing, amazing writer.
Any given production, if given the choice, I would prefer to see the movie first and then the book just because there's so many disappointments when you go the other way around. But if you see the movie and you like the movie and then you discover the book, you know, hopefully you still retain some of that love for the movie and it hasn't diminished, but the book just opens up a whole new, you know, the world for you. Some people feel the other way around, but then they find themselves just hating the movies.
Yeah, I feel the other way around because the movies tend to colonize my visual imagination so that my main character has to look like Brad Pitt or something now.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, wouldn't you be a little less interested in reading a 500-page book when you already know so much about the story?
That's true, yeah. But before we wrap up here, does anyone want to do any real quick pimping and whoring about, you know, what they have out there for the general public's enjoyment or for their own financial gain? Let's start with Steven.
I got a collection of stories coming out here in October, November, the ones that got away. And then I guess some more stuff I can't talk about yet, but soon.
How about you, Logan? Anything to pimp a hoe?
I just wrapped up shooting for a web pilot that we're going to be shopping around to different web studio outlets. And after that, you know, then I might have something, you know, legit to pimp. Beyond that, what I'm doing now, one of my side jobs is for the web series industry, I'm doing reviews for a site called Tube Filter. They're essentially the Variety or Hollywood Reporter of the web series industry.
Awesome.
And so I'm starting to become their irascible, always hungover reviewer. So
you could really get on the front end of something like that, I think.
Yeah. And I just have such a respect for the industry and a desire to raise the standards. And I think up to this point, a lot of the reviewers have been placating simply because this industry is so small and everyone knows everyone. It's really tough to review down a show because, you know, 9 times out of 10, someone you know worked really hard on it. And it's this weird catch-22 to where that you know, insular community is what has kept us alive. And it's also is what's starting to hold us back. And so I'm hoping that my tough but fair reviews might help get some of that across.
All right. As for me, you know, hit up my site, GordonHyland.com. Grab a copy of my my first book, Major Inversions. You can get that from Amazon or CreateSpace. Gentlemen, it's really been an honor talking films with you guys. I want to thank Logan, Jesse, and Dr. Stephen Graham Jones for hanging out with us on a Friday night here in July. A reminder to visit our homepage, welcometothevelvet.com, and we'll see you guys next time with another brand new Velvet podcast.